kind of, a lot of us are a little bit dependent on seeing his name and having him here because he's been here as long as this group has and longer. Anyway, with that, I'm going to turn it over to John and say, go ahead, John.
Hi, friends. My name is John, and I am a Nick addict, and I am in recovery from this terrible addiction. You know, when people ask you to speak, there's always something that happens. The first thing is, you know, they say you know, there's three speeches. The one you thought you were going to say, the one you said, and the one you damn sure wished you had said. And, you know,
ye gods, it happened already, you guys. Oh, God. I'm sure he'll be right back. Oh, and he was just going to talk about this very thing, I think. Yes. That's all you get. It's been a big day around here. Well, guys, man. Here he comes. He's coming. There he is. Go ahead, John.
Sorry about that, folks. Yahoo apparently thought that you didn't need to hear from me for the whole hour anyway. So maybe that's out of its system for a while. So here I sit trying to think of something to say. I guess I'll start at the very beginning. Like a lot of us addicts, I was born at a very young age. And it kind of went downhill from there. Seriously, I guess you know, we do have a lot. We do have some things in common. You know, at least most of us kind of have what if childhood, and we, you know, most of us are exposed to addictions of one kind or another, and you know, there's. In actuality, there was some abuse in my childhood, and some things that weren't really white picket fence stuff. I was kind of a small kid. You know, I was the one kid in the class, and that was the one that everybody always picked on. Yeah, I was a little smaller. My birthday was in September. I was a little bit smaller than the other kids. And so I was the one that always got pushed around, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I learned one of two things, you know, and they'd say, well, stand up for yourself and beat the crap out of them. Well, you know, if you stood up for yourself, that was, and beat the crap out of them, I found out they ran to their parents, you know, and then I really was in trouble. It was the sort of thing, I was one of the original latchkey children, you know. I mean, my folks were both working back in the, long before it became fashionable, you know, it was, not because we were aspiring to be rich and professional stuff, but it was because they both had to. and they, of course, were children of the Depression. My, to put a little, we'll give you an idea here. I was born in 46, so I am the first leading edge of the baby boomers. I am a month and a half younger than Bill Clinton, and you know, George Bush was born in 46 too. So you know, that gives you kind of an idea about my age here. Like I said, I had the so-so childhood. And one of these things that went along with the so-so childhood was that I'm going to tell you a little bit about one of the things. I think the most traumatic year I ever had was my eighth grade year, I had this eighth grade English teacher who, was horrible. It was one of those that made examples out of you. By the way, folks, we make fun of my typing, and we treat it as a joke. But I am dyslexic, and I have poor eye to hand ability, so my handwriting is less than legible a lot of times. I have to be very careful. Anyway, I had, that year I was getting beaten at home, I was getting picked on by the kids, and had an English teacher that was on my case. I just felt horrible, and, that was the worst year I ever had, growing up. But there were some that were fairly close to that, too, it was just like you didn't have a whole lot of happy childhood in there. One thing, like I said, I was picked on by the other kids, and was no adults around. And one of the things that happened, if I did actually beat them up, then like I said, their parents were on me, and I was a badass. So I've been there, and that's. And I guess what I'm talking about is, that, like, I probably had what a psychologist would call low self-esteem. Hey, you feel shitty all the time. You don't like what's happening to you, and all that sort of stuff. But then, like a lot of us do, I do have some redeeming qualities. I've always had the ability to, stand up in front of people and talk, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, it all worked out, and everything works cool, and all this sort of stuff. One of the things about these addictions is that most of us have people in our families who are addicted, and it was so with me. My father was an alcoholic, and he went to his grave smoking a pipe. In fact, this house, 10 years after his death, just still stuck the pipe smoke. Now, yeah, pipe smoke just permeates and lasts until you paint over it, sort of deal. But my father was both an alcoholic and a smoker, and I remember growing up that he had these long Chesterfields, maybe some of you, I know Ross is old enough to remember them, and probably a good portion of the group is. They were non-filter, and boy, they had richest tobacco taste. Anyway, that's what Dad smoked for a while there, and I, every once in a while I would deal with steal a pack of Chesterfields and try to smoke one, and the rest of the pack would sit around for 6 months before you got brave and tried it again, because your first cigarette is you sit there and you smoke the damn thing and you wonder what in the hell anybody sees on it. And I didn't actually pick up smoking until after high school. Believe it or not, I wasn't one of these people that, had to have a cigarette in the ninth grade. I was pretty well through high school when I started smoking. In fact, I graduated in 1964 and went off to Idaho State University. I was born in Pocatello, Idaho, and raised in a little place called Twin Falls, Idaho. Yeah, I didn't. I started smoking when I went to Idaho State, and one of the things that like really turned me on was I don't know if any of you remember Philip Morris in the mid '60s put out a cigarette called the Multifilter, and they were in the little plastic packages that fit in your shirt tail shirt pocket so neat. They looked really neat in your shirt pocket, and you know they were. A fairly mild cigarette. And so, I could sit around the student union building and smoke these cigarettes and look cool, you know, and drink coffee and pretend to be studying and all this sort of stuff. You know, there is something about my story here, and I am recovering from another addiction. And, you know, it's part of my story. I'm not going to dwell on it too much, but because it is a part of my story and goes hand in hand with smoking, I will be sharing it. You know, and one of the things that happened was I was sitting there smoking these cigarettes, having a great old time. And in 1965, I had a situation where I was on my way home from school, and I was riding with somebody. And he hit another car. It was a five-car pileup due to some weed burning. I went through the windshield of the automobile. And, you know, at that point, I had to have extensive plastic surgery, and my face was torn up for a couple of years. As a matter of fact, I still have a tear duct that's kind of screwed up and waters every once in a while. Now, you know, anything about this is that, like, you get in a wreck like that. The folks decided to sue, and I ended up being a fairly well-financed person there for the next couple of years. There's almost truth to that, Dan. Anyway, what happened about that time was that along with the smoking, now to this point, I had, I would smoke a cigarette every once in a while. If I was going out on a date or something with a girl who didn't smoke, that was cool. I didn't need a cigarette. You know, I wasn't inhaling, all this sort of stuff. And, they were pretty much cosmetic cigarettes. And I tried to, along about this time was a corn cob pipe experiment. You know, at that time you could buy corn cob pipes for about 39 cents. And they lasted about as long as one pouch of tobacco before they burned out. Especially if you smoked them real fast, you know, and I did that. You know, I didn't know how to smoke a pipe, I didn't know how to smoke a cigarette, but I was sure pretending. Well, you know, in 66, I reached a settlement with this insurance company, and I immediately was able to afford all the beer I wanted. And, before I knew it, I was drinking and smoking pretty much around the clock. I kind of made it through junior college by the hair of my teeth, went down to Idaho State and went there and actually drank my way out of college. That's the sort of stuff that happened. And all this time I'm smoking, of course. One of the things was that, when you're drinking, those cigarettes sure taste good. And when you're hungover, God, you need it to calm your nerves. I picked up at least a two-pack-a-day habit. I was pretty much pretty much if I wasn't walking down the walking or doing physical labor, I had a cigarette in my hand. You know, if I wasn't sleeping, I had a cigarette in my hand. And that's by this time, of course, the money was the money had run out. The money ran out somewhere along the line, and I'd been fortunate enough to work, and in summer '74, I kind of hit a bottom where I couldn't, where I wasn't working, and I couldn't afford to drink, couldn't afford to smoke, couldn't afford to pay the rent, couldn't afford this, couldn't afford that, and I ended up coming down to Albuquerque and hitting on my parents for a while. A while turned into a long time. You know, a funny thing about these addictions is that they will get you. And somewhere along the line between 1976 when I hit here and January 4th of 79, I got tired of drinking. I was able to deal with that addiction. In fact, the only reason I know it was January 4th of 79, I knew the year. The year is pretty hard to miss. I pieced together the days. I was hungover New Year's, the second. Third day, I felt better. I had to go out and get some hair of the dog. And the fourth day, I ended up in AA. You know, I've been sober since my first meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous. I found the 12 steps, and I loved the 12 steps, and they worked. And one thing, you folks know. Those of you who are members of both fellowships know this very well. We in both fellowships, we talk about the addiction that we have. Seldom have I heard in an AA meeting anybody talking about smoking. Unless it was somebody who just hated smoke and wanted everybody wanted a smoke-free meeting, which there were very few of here in Albuquerque. But I'd love to tell you that I saw the light in about two, three years into my sobriety that I just was able to walk away from the cigarettes. Well, that didn't happen till about 20 years sober. Anything happened, I ended up in another one of these financial jackpots about 5 years ago. We started a small jewelry company. It hadn't worked out. I had to find a job quick and find a job in earnest. So I took a job as a security officer. You don't need to know a whole lot to be a security officer. You just pretty much got to show up and know how to walk around and nominally write reports and in some places interface with the public. And I'm not too bad about, being in public. I can talk to people, et cetera. So I did that. And one of the first things that happened was that I pulled onto this post Christmas Day of 1999, lit up a cigarette, and promptly tried to put my hand out the window, which was rolled up, and the cherry fell on this polyester uniform, and poof, big hole in the pants. Embarrassed as hell, I took the pants in, and somebody says, we can replace them. And then I said, but you ought to quit smoking. Funniest damn thing. I never really thought about it. I never really thought about quitting smoking. Sometime that January, I was sitting in my local AA club, and I was smoking a cigarette, and you know, I was getting to the point this time, folks, where I couldn't breathe. And I hadn't even thought about quitting smoking. I was 20 years sober and hadn't thought about quitting smoking. I'm sitting there with a cigarette, and dropped this cigarette out, dropped it down this tube in the smoking stand, and said, gee, I wonder how long I can go without a cigarette. Well, I went into this AA meeting where I generally smoked about 6 cigarettes through the meeting, chain smoking, and I didn't smoke one. And nobody noticed. And that's okay, because that wasn't why I did it, was to call attention to me. I just wanted to see if I could, how long I could go without a cigarette. I heard something about a little trick. They said, you know, hide your cigarettes, so it takes a conscious effort to go get them. So I hid my cigarettes. And the next day I had, now this is a guy who couldn't not smoke for 5 minutes. You've got to understand this. When the next day he had, and I was still without a cigarette, I did the right thing. I went and gave my buddy a carton and a half of cigarettes that I had. And guess what, folks? That crazy little quit started with just asking a question how long I could go. Lasted about 10 months, amazingly enough. You know, see, that's the thing about addictions, is that, like, you know, it's sure taken me a long time to learn this. And we talk about that. You know, people come in here and they say, well, you know, how do you do this? What's happening? You know, we talk about nicotine replacement and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, we tell them that each one's different. You're going to have to learn. You know, you're going to have to play with this yourself. And that's kind of the way it is. You know, but out of that quit, eventually what happened was I was living in this really cheap apartment. Those of you who have lived in real cheap apartments know a couple of things about real cheap apartments. If you don't have a decent landlord, they become drug places. And that's what happened to this place. You know, it become overrun with druggies. Then they had some managers in that weren't taking care of stuff. And lo and behold, that year, which was the year 2000, my damn apartment building was condemned by the city, and I had to find an apartment in a hurry. Well, you know, one of the things that had happened when I quit was that a pack of cigarettes, unbeknownst to me, had fallen under the bed. In the process of this thing where moved somebody into me, in next door to me, that had a party constantly going on between Labor Day and Thanksgiving. I don't know how they slept with that stereo blaring, but, you know, I mean, from Labor Day to Thanksgiving, that stereo was going. I was at wit's end, and I found this pack of cigarettes, and I chain-smoked the whole goddamn pack, and that broke that quit. You know, and here I was. You know, I've been about 10 months smoker. I said, well, shit, that one was easy. I'll just quit again. Wrong. You know, I knew intuitively that that wouldn't happen, but, you know, it's one of those things that you have to prove to yourself. It's one of those things that, damn it, you know. See, if quitting smoking was easy, we wouldn't need this group. You know, we wouldn't need to be here. A lot of things we wouldn't need. You know, for me, you know, I had this strange thought, and I thought that, like, you know, if I could ever get to the 12 steps to work on smoking, I think that that's I was kind of doing that. Somewhere along the line, after getting my ass thrown out of that apartment over there, I got this computer and I got online. And I've been playing around on this computer that we had for the business, and I was in a Microsoft chat room one day. And keep in mind, I'm about a year and a half into this relapse when this happens. I'm wishing there was some way I could quit smoking, wishing that the magic would happen again, you know, and knowing that the harder I tried, and trying harder wasn't making it happen. And anyway, I was sitting in this Microsoft chat room, and this chat room, it was kind of like everybody's anonymous, everything from Emotions Anonymous to, Del Pickles Anonymous, I think. There were two addictions that they wouldn't have. One of them was a sexual addiction, and the other was nicotine. Well, when people don't handle nicotine addictions, it's because because people were smoking. This gal comes kind of stumbling in there and tells me about this nicotine group, and she led me to Unofficial Nicanon. And that's where I met you folks, was over in what is now the Type Show group at Unofficial. And I remember, Ross was at my first meeting, Carol was at my first meeting, and Kim Bohannon, that guy that died, Ross, people do die here, see, that's another thing, folks. Some of us are going to be passing away over a time or two. But anyway, so I ended up in this group over this Unofficial Nicanon. And this Tuesday meeting Carol had, and she needed a chairperson. She kind of suggested that I chair, and so I kind of said yes, and I chaired that meeting for a year. I was around here, and I was doing this thing. I found new people. I found a way to go, and I was trying, but it wasn't happening. When I was here a little over a year, a funny thing happened. I ended up in the hospital with heart failure. And, I was a smoker at the time. It's the damnedest thing. I was a smoker at the time and ended up in the hospital with heart failure. Was in there a week, and the first thing I did when I got out of the hospital, after being in there a week, was pick up a damn smoke. The doc would send me to these classes and all this sort of stuff. Grayson, that's exactly what I was thinking. This goddamn addiction. What's it gonna take? Here I was in this room, and by this point, I want to tell you something. One of the things was that, I kind of got tired of resetting my calendar. So, I don't have a calendar. And a funny thing happened, I don't know what it was about January 1st that people who deal with addictions tell you to, to pick an insignificant date. But 2 years ago, I picked January 1st. And we were over at Unofficial at the time, and by the way, folks, this group, got started on Pal Talk about 3 years ago, Actually, about 3 years ago. So we, or maybe it's four now. Damn, it's a long time anyway. We kind of, Roz and I kind of just got started with this, with a Sunday meeting on Powell Talk. And, by the way, folks, I'm one of those people that does something that everybody says not to do. Roz is my sponsor. I have a female sponsor. And it seems to work pretty well for us. We're both too old to get, for anything crazy to happen. Seems to work. But anyway, the thing that happened was that, on New Year's, 2 years ago, despite everything, I was able to put down the cigarettes, and I was able to come in, and, to stay with you people. So, one of the things that has amazed me about this group when I came here, I've been all over the web looking for a place to quit smoking, and there were all kinds of places. I found a place over on Microsoft at the time called Cold Turkey Support Group. Well, what they wanted was that they wanted you to not sign up for the group until you had been sober about 10 days. Well, shit, if I knew how to get sober 10 days, I wouldn't need a group. And through all this relapsing and stuff, you folks stood behind me. But more importantly, when I first hit this place, you told me that I was welcome smoking or not. Now those of you who deal with Alcoholics Anonymous know that they discourage active drunks from going in meetings. And here, and here we welcome people like that. We welcome people who are in the addiction. You told me, I said, what are the rules here? And they said, well, the only requirement is a desire to quit smoking, to quit using nicotine. Well, how do you do that? And they said, damned if I know. I tried this, and I tried that, and some people the patch worked, some people the Wellbutrin worked, some people did it cold turkey, some people did it that. But, everybody here had supported people that were going through the same thing, and that's why this thing works. Because even if we don't do it all exactly the same, we all do it. And we're all going through the same thing. When somebody tells me, says that I got 2 days sober and I'm sober and I'm shaken, we all know what they're talking about. You people are the ones that, have helped me with this stuff. I'd love to tell you, this whole lifetime thing has been kind of a strange trip because, from that childhood, I ended up in kind of a life track where I made a lot of money for other people but never really got ahead myself. And, I'm entering close to retirement age, and I ended up with a house and some money. I don't have a lot of things that people think they need to have to be happy. But I'll tell you what, I ain't struggling, and I'm a pretty happy camper. And that's because of you people taught me about what's important. You people taught me somewhere along the line about what's important in this life. And it isn't what's important, what you grow up with. What's important is what you give to other people while you're here. I never knew how to do that, see, until people in the 12-step program showed me how to do that. You know, you people were responsible for my life. Never been happier. This thing works. You know, it really does. You know, and I had to kind of take a look back on the 27 years I've been around, been an Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, been without a drink. And, you know, I look at the people over the years that, like, have come and gone, and people who drank like I smoked, you know, relapsed or kind of. And, you know, I've come to realize over the years that, you know, I've been a little less in love with people. You know, and the nice thing about these character defects is that if you just open your heart a bit, God's going to come and God's going to show you. You know, you folks told me, you folks have showed me that. You folks showed me that, like, all you have to do is be willing. You know, and the funniest thing, you know, I guess, you know, we're going to end up talking a little bit about this this wonderful group of people. You know, we've been in existence about 14 years. We have almost 1,000 people in this room. We're in this booth right now. You know, Ross and I thought when we started this thing, we were lucky to have half of that. You know, we have we probably have 30 meetings plus. You know, and Roz and I would have thought we'd be lucky to have half of that. You know, I don't know how many people were here tonight, but the room was full. You know, thought we'd be lucky to do half that. You people amaze me. You make me. You demonstrate that the love is out there beyond my wildest dreams. It's just the most amazing thing. And you know, I owe you people my life, so thank you for my life. And go ahead. I think I'm done.
Thank you, John. That's awesome. And you know what I like the best is I learned some new things about you that I didn't know before. That's why I love hearing people speak. I can know them a long time and get to learn more things about them. Loved your share, John. Thank you so much. Wanted to tell you guys, for new people, that April of this, was it, yes, 2005.